hope we come on to the rise of boundaries. Apparently that wasn't possible. Would you all mind, sorry, if we have, could you all turn your phones off, please? Thank you for your time. Anselm really doesn't need any introduction. He has made 7 shows in the last 12 years with White Cube. In the 1990s, he was his work is well known in London, and he's an artist whose work attracts a lot of people to his exhibitions in London. Witness the triumph, I think I could say, at the Royal Academy in 2014, following on from an extraordinary installation in the courtyard in 2007. The current exhibition, which opens tomorrow night at White Cube in Bermondsey, centres around the theme of Valhalla. And Anselm, I know that this is a question that British journalists were already focusing in on, and I think it's a good subject to begin with, which is, although you work around a lot of themes, mythical themes, Germanic themes, people are seeing this exhibition in a specifically political context. How do you respond to that? How much is this about what is happening in the Middle East or happening in different parts of the world at the moment, and how much is it part of your broader exploration?
I always allow people to see what they want. Because the people who look at the painting, they do help out to create the painting. The artist does his part, and everyone who looks at the painting has another painting in his head then. So they are a creator too. So if someone wants to take me for a political artist, why not? I'm not, but you can take me for that.
You were very much a political artist when you began, so I don't think we can let you off the hook so easily with that. When you were a student, having seen examples of it on the rotating series, in 1969, your diploma work, you made a series of photographs called Heroic Symbols. You also made a series of photographs, which you're still using, involving the then band Salute. That was political.
No, it was not. No, it was to find out myself what I would have done in those times and what I think about that. And so it was something to do with me. And certainly all what you do, all what I do, is directed also by the politics. So I read 3 newspapers every day, I look sometimes TV, so I'm well informed. But I don't think that I can direct politicians. This I cannot do.
I think it's very interesting that you, the heroic symbols and the occupations were done for yourself. I think you said not so long ago, I think you said on a number of occasions, that you wanted to find out what you would have done in the situation that faced your father's generation, your grandfather's generation. Did you ever come close to answering that? Did you ever come close to answering what you might have done?
I ask me always, what do you think what you have done? But I don't know it. I hope that I did the right thing. But when I had done this action, then I studied a lot about this time. I studied a lot about the fascism, about the extinguishing of the Jews and all this. I know now a lot of things. So now I'm really intelligent about that, but I still don't know what I would have done in those times without any knowledge or as a young boy.
It was quite clear that your generation, and I think you and perhaps Georg Baslitz above all, but you above even he, were seen as trying to remind Germany that a kind of collective amnesia was not acceptable in the late 60s and that the country had to face up to its past rather than bury it. You may plead not guilty to that, but moving on, the point I want to ask you is, how much do you think that idea is still necessary? How much has Germany dealt with or exercised or worked through its collective past?
I must say that Germany is now a good example, because from 75 on, there was a lot in the media. you could read everywhere about this time, and in the TV, in the radio, in books. So they did, I think they did a lot to know about this time. But when I was studying in the 60s, nobody knows anything about that. And I studied first law in Freiburg, and my teachers, some of my teachers was Nazi, you know, and they was not removed from the university. And you know, the best conseiller, the advisor of Adenauer, was a man who wrote the laws against the Jewish. And so Germany would never come so quick up if they would have put all the Nazis in a jail. And that is one of the things that they let them there. So no one judge was condemned after the war. Not one. It's completely crazy, no?
Were you angry about that? Angry as a young man that no one was held to account.
I was wondering. I thought, how is this possible? Angry, I don't know, but I thought it's not possible.
And how was Wagner generally, and the myth around the Valkyrie, how was that when you were a young man? How was that seen?
I remember when I was a young boy, let's say perhaps 14 years old or so, and then my mother put on the radio, and it was the Lohengrin from Bayreuth. And this, I think, defined me for the rest of my life, you know? This far, region, you can never go there, but you are dying to see this region. It's a symbol. This Lohengrin, this Montferrat, this region, is a symbol for wishes. They cannot be completed. You can say complete, but you know, if you wish complete, you are disappointed. So I was very impregnated by this opera for the rest of my life.
So, was there any sense of wanting to decontaminate Wagner? It's a very complex thing, Wagner's relationship to Nazism, often unjustly accused of holding all sorts of different views, sometimes justly, but did you feel, having fallen under the spell of Wagner's music, that there is an element of wanting to reclaim his reputation in the way that you wanted to reclaim other
musicians? You know, there is always a big difference between the man as a person, and what he does. So we have this, with a lot of people, this problem. And we have with Céline, Voyage au bout de la nuit. We have it with Martin Heidegger, and we have it with Wagner. Wagner was a real anti-Semite, a real one. So, right. But this is not influencing his music. Not at all, I think.
So, Valhalla now, is it now a decontaminated myth? Is the ring cycle now for you something that you can explore in a poetic, mythical way rather than specifically in a political way?
You know, this myth, like Valhalla, like Völund, the Forger, and all this, they are still alive. You know, sometimes I look a little bit with my children to this horrible film of the Thrones. No,
Game of Thrones.
And a long time, isn't it? I see all the Greek mythology. I see all the mythologies, but they don't know it, where it comes from. You know, you don't know it. And you have to find the roots of these mythologies to deal with them in an intellectual way. Not to be overwhelmed by the Thrones or whatever.
So, what about the contemporary resonance of Valhalla then? You're saying that for you, it's something that you fell in love with as a young man, that the whole Germanic myth around, and the Nordic myth around Valhalla, are things that interest you in a much broader spectrum. It's history as a kind of subject, rather than its contemporary resonance. However, everyone in London I've spoken to sees your interest in Valhalla relating to Syria,
you know,
Aleppo.
I was yesterday in the Tate Britain, one of the wonderful museum. I like the Tate Britain, you know, the architecture is fantastic. I hope I will do a show once again.
Okay, you're not
prison. Can you can help me look at the prison? Yes, I would like to do this. And there, I thought I cannot. I had an hallucination. I saw a painting of Turner, Valhalla, of Ravenswood. He painted this horrible temple and the Danube, and that's amazing, no? I said to my gallerist, we need this painting in the show, you know. We will see if it will arrive, you know.
Yeah. Short notice. Okay. You're brilliant actually tonight, Ansa. I'm not laying a glove on you with the resonance with Aleppo and Syria that people are seeing. But you, as you said at the beginning, for you, people will bring their own frames of reference to whatever is there. But I am interested as to how the subject of specifically Valhalla has found its way into your art now. You work in ongoing series. Your work is, and the series in some ways never ends. I want to talk to you about that later. But do you have a sense of why Valhalla has suddenly become a subject? But I'm not sure.
It was not suddenly. Valhalla was in my mind since, let's say, since I started to be an artist in '68.
Why? When I visited your studio last 6 months ago, there was no, unless you were hiding it, it's possible in the vast studio you have in Quincy, but I saw no trace of the current exhibition. I saw many of the fragments of the work, and I saw the basis of some of the work, but the notion that you would move towards the subject of Valhalla wasn't there. Why has that emerged in the last 6 months?
You know, we have Valhalla in Bergerac, in the south of France. There are these towers that I painted now. Sometimes I do an action, I do an installation like I did in the south of France. And then I paint over this. I paint this installation, and this I did. But I didn't know that it will be in Valhalla. I thought I have to paint this towers once. And then I thought it could be Valhalla. The painting told me what it wanted to be.
People are fascinated by that, how subject matter, content materialize themselves in your work. How does a work then, broadly speaking, begin, if it's possible to talk about this? What is the beginning of the process?
Oh, when I begin a painting, you mean a painting, for example? So a painting I do, I'm in the color, I'm in the material, I just start, and I do something. I don't know what I do, I just do something. Because I'm very physical, so I dance around and I do something. And then after a while, I put it up on the wall and I look at it. And then there is a discussion between the painting and me, and I'm reflecting what I thought, what the painting wanted to say to me. And then I change it. If I make a decision, I change it, and then it's another. And it, then a few days later, a few weeks later, I put it again on the wall. And so it goes on and on until I think it could be finished, until the gallerist comes and says, we need now some painting, so they have to be finished.
Some works are still in your studio that you began in the early 70s, that in a sense, I would say not finished, but I think I'm fascinated by the whole notion of finish with you, because you just said nicely, gently, flippantly, that when there's a show, you need to finish your work. When you see work you made 30 years ago that exists in someone's collection or in a museum, do you still have the impulse to work on
it? Yes, it works on danger then. So, so the collectors doesn't let me in. So, and you know, when you do a show, I just had a big show in the Pompidou this year, and I was excluded. I couldn't touch my painting, you know. It was forbidden. The police was around me. They don't touch my paintings. I didn't want to change them, but I can even not take them and put them on the wall. There's a piece and police. And then
so, sorry,
I told you.
You said it's a bad idea. I just wanted to do the right thing.
I didn't mean this, you know, this looks so strange.
where was I? Oh, yeah. So the notion of finish for you, given your obsession with the idea of transformation and manipulation, by definition, a work of art, it's almost impossible to finish for you.
Yes, you know, our last exhibition, you know, it was, I had a lot of paintings in the Jopping Gallery, and they was put in electrolysis. And then during the show, the painting changed, you know. And some of the collectors understood this, you know. No one painting came back, no?
He's not, it's okay. He's not going to admit that in public, is he? He's not going to admit that in public if anything kept. No, but it was very interesting that during the penultimate room at the Royal Academy had the Morgenthau plant, which were paintings that had also been subject to or involved electrolyzed material. And I witnessed, I wouldn't say daily, but at least every week, it seemed to be a subtle change in the
wonderful. And it changed all the time. Yes, fantastic.
Yeah, but of course, museums, collectors want some kind of permanence. So in a way, that's not a provocation. You're playing with the idea of the anything can ever be fixed, I suppose.
No, I don't play with the idea. I just think it's necessary that things change. And I'm not happy if something is fixed like this. And, you know, when you look at the haystacks of Monet, you know, the time changed. It was the morning at 10, and then 12, and then at 4, he made his painting, and the sun changed. What is the nice thing is, to look between the paintings then. You know, you don't look at the painting, look between what combines them, what binds them, combines them together.
What binds them together? you mentioned Monet, and Monet is a serial...
Hold it like this.
You mentioned Monet, and Monet became a serial artist, and it was in the last 4 decades of his life. I'm very interested in how the series works for you. Once you get involved in a particular series, this is an immersive thing, but you're also able to work on different series at the same time. Is that right? Or is it full immersion?
Sure, I wait on different things, and it's good to work on different things, because if one thing gets quiet, it doesn't tell you anything, and it's death for the moment for you. You go to another one, and you have another sensation.
The studios that you've had over the years, I think, are works of art in and of themselves. There was a brick factory at Buchen, then Barjac, an extraordinary creation, which I'll talk about specifically in a minute, and then Kwasi. Do you always now see the studio as a work of art in itself, as well as a place of work or a laboratory, or does that just emerge as you start to create in it?
No, the studio is not a work of art. I think the studio is like my brain, my outskirts brain. And I have a big studio, it's 250 meters long, and there are a lot of unfinished things, there are objects that I collected. And when I go through all this stuff, then suddenly it's like in the brain, the synapses, some objects are all of a sudden, they click together.
They fire, yeah.
They fire. And for all in the evening when I'm very tired and I don't think so much, my brain, more here, then I have a lot of sensations, and it's true, but it's my brain outspots.
But Barjac, in a way, has become a work of art, hasn't it?
Yeah, Barjac is coming to a certain resolution. But I'm still continuing. I'm still building buildings there, and tunnels, and bridges, and it's still a work in progress.
And yet, you've also invited a number of artists. Wolfgang Leib has made an installation,
the rumour is that Marina Abramovich is considering or will perhaps make an installation.
So she was there, we have some project, yeah.
Yeah. So is this is obviously the next stage, but is this you handing over something, or will you still remain creatively involved with it?
No, since I'm leaving, I will continue to work there, certainly. But I have people there, they're working, and I go there very often. No, it continues.
But I'm interested in the relationship between control and a kind of loss of control or chaos in your work. I mean, it seems to me there's a loss of control and there's a loss of chaos. And
yes.
Specifically in relation to Barjac, this is a very interesting moment that you've let go to a certain extent, but you're still holding on as well.
No, in general, it's an important thing to have the balance between chaos and organization. If it's too much chaos, nothing comes out, you know. If it's too much organization, then it's all dead, you know. So that's the most important thing for now, to have the balance between chaos and organization.
You mentioned your brain as the kind of synaptic shuffle going on. And in one of the rooms at YQ in the current exhibition, it's the second room on the right as you go down the main corridor. There is what I think you're describing either as an arsenal or an arsenal or an archive room, where there is all sorts of different materials and ancient machinery and so on, which is both ordered, it's sort of boxed and classified, then things seep out. I'm curious as to how you use material, how that reflects your use of material. It's like a kind of giant palette, yeah, as much as it is your mind.
Yeah, what you see in the gallery is a small part of my arsenal. Arsenal is what I collect all the things, unfinished books, photos, small things, things what I find in the world, mushrooms, all kinds of things. This is all collected there, and what's your question?
You've heard an answer already, which is, it's a kind of palette, it's a room, your archive or arsenal is your armory. This is the material that you will use as well as it. But you talked about your studio being a reflection of your mind, your brain.
It's not a palette. It's more. It's the same thing. What I describe as a synapses. There are a lot of things, you know, and they are inscribed in my memory, and I can see it. Oh, up there I have some teeth from some patient. You know, I collect those teeth. And I have friends, dentist friends who collected all the teeth what they took out. No, it's not a joke, no. It's because when you see these teeth, they take out the bad teeth, you know, and you see all the misery of the world in there, you know, you see the holes, and when you collect this, so this is one of my collections, and I have other things, you know, and I have collected my nails all the time, you know.
Your nails?
My nails, yes. You shouldn't give away nothing, you know. And then I find out that because there's a ship in the Northern Mythology, it's called the Argonaut ship, and that's made of the nails of dead warriors. Can you imagine? This is completely crazy. But I found this, and so my nails was used for that.
I think
you can give me yours too.
I'd be honoured. I think this idea of obsessive collecting is fascinating. And it's only recently I've heard you say, I never throw anything away. And it's clear when you moved a lot of your archive or arsenal from Barjac to Kwasi, it's there, it's in containers, it's been unpacked. And every time one goes to the studio, there's dentist chairs, printing machines, there's different things you're collecting. Were you an obsessive collector as a child? Did you hoard things or have collections?
Yes, I liked it, but my mother was so German precise that they always threw all away. No, she didn't like us. She didn't like the things. So she always cleaned it up, and it was a real problem for me.
You talked about your childhood in many ways, but you said about the idea of emptiness. That it was a childhood where, I mean, in the aftermath of the war, you were born in 1945, that there wasn't much, if anything, and so one of your impulses was to fill things up.
Yes, a child has no moral prescriptions. A child takes what it sees as it is, without any connotation, you know? And for this reason, you keep well all what you see in your childhood, you know, and you can work with it. But that was not the question, no?
But you talk about emptiness.
Yeah. So, I grew up in a village, and there was nothing. No television, we had no radio. The radio had a little one. And there was no entertainment, there was nothing. And I was bored all the time, but bored in a good sense, you know? You know, Martin Heidegger, he made one, was heißt eine Vorlesung, Speyer. He made one semester lecture about boredom. Because when you are bored, you get philosopher, because then you reflect about what you feel. So if you're always in action, you don't get philosopher. So this boredom, this emptiness, is very helpful. And today I see with my children that it's difficult to recreate a place where it can be boredom.
Is that why you meditate regularly? Is it to empty yourself out?
Yeah, sure. That's one method to do it.
Do you not find living as you do in a vast 35,000 square meter studio complex filled with stuff, your collection? Do you find that daunting, overwhelming? I mean, there's so much stuff there. It's the opposite of emptiness.
For me, it's completely cozy, you know? I can't understand this. No, I go there. It's my home.
Well, evidently. But I just wonder whether there is ever a sense of wanting to, I mean, the notion that you meditate, you empty out, whether there's ever a sense of wanting. I mean, I suppose a blank canvas, every time there's a blank canvas, that is for you the start of something, it's the emptying out, and then you start saying.
No, this is another thing. If I could have another building the same size, I would leave this and I would start a new one. Going from one to the other, it's possible.
The whole notion of you creating, you talked a little about, but you said, I think rather memorably, in a speech you gave for the Freedom Prize in Germany in 2008, that you think in images. And part of the description you've just given us is about engagement materially. So, without being too prescriptive, do you reach certain stages of resolution when images seem to become clear? Or is it, and I'm curious about the relationship between intellectual clarity that I sometimes see in your work and the visual clarity. Because if you think in images, fundamentally it's about visual clarity.
No, although here has to be a balance between the intellect and between the emotion and between the will. All three things have to be in a certain balance and then it's good. You know, I like very much minimal art, like Walter Maria, I like very much. But I must say, at the same time, I miss something there. I miss some emotion. And when you have all three things in one thing, then it's the best. And I think the minimal art, there was a reaction of too much painting, or perhaps too much. There was nice, good results. But I think today we have to recreate this balance. Because when you look at all these people who are on the internet and they see all just signs, they don't speak anymore, they keep signs in. And then there is not this balance, you know? And I think we have to do this balance.
Between the material, the spiritual, the intellectual, and the vision.
Between the intellect, the emotion,
yeah.
And the will.
People have seen very strongly a spiritual or religious dimension in your art, and certainly religion, I think, is one of the great subjects of your art. It's part of the content. How much is art an affirmation of your spiritual beliefs in the world, or part of your journey to understand spiritually what the world might be? How much is it a kind of surrogate religion?
No, it's not necessarily, but art is a different thing from religion. Religion helps you in life. Art doesn't help you in life. Art is combined with the truth. Art is divide, truth. And but I studied a lot of religion. I was raised Catholic, and in the 80s I made a show in Jerusalem, and then I studied a lot of Jewish mysticism, the Kabbalah, and all this, because I thought in the Jewish religions there's more I learn. It's not the Catholic is so the contrary of chaos. So order, and they had to do this because in the second century after Jesus Christ, they had to fight against all the other, against the New Platonism, against all the other religions around, and so they had to be very strict to tell them what they have to believe and what not.
So you were talking about your interest in Jewish mysticism. What did you find in mysticism and the Kabbalah in particular that interested you? The notion of the creator removing himself, the withdrawal.
No, for example, Isaac Luria, he made another story about the beginning of the world. You know, we learned God was sitting there, had argil and put some animals and then the human beings and
breath
and then so he said he is more and more intellectual and more less ungreifbar, less vulnerable as a system, because he said God, who is all and nothing, all. He was retrieving himself a little bit to keep the space free for the world to develop itself. So it is very clever, because they can't believe it. They have always a problem with the best of the world. It wasn't good, and they have so much bad things. So it's difficult for them. And there, it got retrieves himself, creates an empty room, and then they don't have this problem.
The Jewish mystical tradition was also that which was almost obliterated in Germany when you were growing up. So in a sense, there was also the discovery of that was part of the reclamation of that tradition?
No, because the Catholics are part of the Catholic. We learned not from the New Testament or the Old Testament. The Old Testament is connected to the New Testament, because the Old Testament said already Jesus will be Christ. Jesus will be born, and this will happen. So we are completely in the Jewish tradition too.
So it wasn't like that, but you once did say that it was part of your desire was to try and re-establish something that had virtually been obliterated. But you qualified that position.
Well, that's in another sense too, because in the 20s of the last century, then there was a very big mutual intuition, the Jews and the Germans. What the Germans had, the Jewish had something what the Germans don't have. And inverse too, there was a real good cooperation. And now when the Germans killed all the Jews, so they killed themselves in a way, because one part of themselves they killed too.
You have a very acute sense, I think, well, as a person, but I think in your art on occasions, of the absurd. But I've never felt that you felt religion broadly to be absurd, although there's an absurdist dimension, I suppose, in some of the literalism or fundamentalism of certain religions. What is your broad interest in religion, in art? Is it because it's been such a critical subject matter, or is your interest in exploring the notion that human beings somehow seek to understand that which is beyond themselves, and art, like religion, is a good way of doing that?
No, No, I think it's the same interest I have with mythology, because religion is mythology too. And the mythology tries to give a painting, a picture of the world who is complete. So we have now a lot of scientific departments, you know, and they are not together. But in the mythology, it's still together. The mythology tells how the world is. And then, during the centuries, other people, artists, poets, interpreted these mythology pictures in their way. They continued to work on them. So this is where I combine with religion, because religion is mythology too, in a way.
So, presumably, by extension, science or elements of scientific exploration will become mythology too. By extension, elements of scientific exploration, or the belief we have in certain scientific truths, in inverted commas, now, may become a mythology sometime in the future.
Yes, you know, some of them. I had once a discussion in Vienna with an astrophysician, and Zeitlinger is his name. And we understood each other very well, you know. We spoke about beauty, you know. He was speaking about beauty of his formulas and of his experiments, and I was speaking about beauty of my work, artwork. So there are a lot of connections.
You've often said that beauty is something you want to avoid. I mean, I've heard you being interviewed saying, and I've seen you making paintings, I've seen you film making paintings, where you suddenly have got to a point where you're worried that it will be seen as too beautiful.
Yes, I normally start a painting very beautiful. It looks like a Monet, normally. And then I continue, and then it gets a different thing. Because I feel guilty when I have a nice painting in front of me, you know, with flowers or whatever. Because it's so affirmative. Is this English? Affirmative?
Affirmative, yeah.
Affirmative. And you think, oh, the world is so wonderful. I show you how wonderful the world is. And this I cannot.
Because the world is not
supposed to be wrong. The wrong things are wrong. We have something wrong in our head, you know. Otherwise, it wouldn't be possible that after all this war, it continues and continues. There is something that constructs.
So, the notion of redemption in your art, by definition, is difficult.
I would say transformation. Redemption. It's difficult.
You mentioned, we were just talking about science and astrophysicism. I know that you made a trip to CERN to see the Hadron Collider, but I've not really talked to you about that. How was that trip, and might that feed into your art in terms of imagery or in terms of mythology?
You know, I had a big chance when I was there. They had a problem, and they had to repair it, and it could go down. It goes, how much meters it goes down? It was extreme. It was going down, and I could see the machine where the little elements collide with the other elements. So this was really impressive. There are in the CERN working, I think, 3,000 scientists, and they are connected all over the world with other scientists. So they can rent a certain time, and then they can look at the computer what happens with this little particles. Yeah. And it's interesting that the particles collide. They have millions and millions of results, you know, but they need a computer to choose the results they want, you know. The others go into the garbage, you know. It's such a luxury, you know, what happens there.
Did it make you envious or yearnful of that kind of technological support? Was there any idea that you got from being there of a kind of extraordinarily monumental work of art?
If I gave the option...
No, what I saw... I mean, you're just the little elements, couldn't see even.
No, but it's interesting because you're a man who said recently, and I know you were exploring that, of using a defunct nuclear power station. So it's not as if you have visions of using vast technology. What's interesting about CERN, as you say, it could be microscopic. I mean, the tiniest.
It's more than microscopic. Yeah.
But also, the setup itself, as you just said, is technologically vast. So were you envious of that possibility?
I was not seduced to use this technology because I'm too stupid for that, you know. But I wanted once I was very impressed. In Germany, there is a nuclear power station, and there was producing electricity, and then they shut it down because there was protest from the Green Party, you know. So there was a big fight with the judges, and so it was closed down, and now they built it back. And then I was invited there, and then I saw the cooling tower. And I don't know if you were standing once in one cooling tower. It's so fantastic, you know. Normally there are fields of reservoir, fields of water, but this was out already. And then I was standing in this cooling tower, and it's like the Pantheon. It's fantastic proportions. And I wanted to do something there, and I had a contract with this RWE, it's called RWE, and the Green Party protested. I said I want to put them on the net, but in another way, you know. Anyone could use electricity, you know. I wanted to transform it, what I do all the time. And then, but in Germany, you know, they wanted green fields, you know. They don't want me to be a member of this. And so, now it will be a good thing.
Over your city's grass will grow, one of your favourite quotes. In a way, you've dealt, I think, with the issue of scale, because you talked about that you're interested in the microscopic, but also you hinted that you're interested in the macrocosmic. How is scale determined by you when you work? You know, you have a vast working place. What determines or what links the vastness of some of your work and the tiny hands-on nature of other aspects of it?
I don't see them vast, my work. It's just as it should be. You know, it's, for me, it's completely normal. I never understand this question.
I think a 9 meter towers or the desire to work in a defunct power station.
No, I mean, you know, this cooling tower was 62 meters high.
Yeah, but you wanted to work with it, so
I found it really handsome, you know,
and
something with it.
Yes, and appropriate. So,
yeah, it's, you know, I do also watercolors, they're big like this.
Yes.
And then it's fine too.
Yes. Sure. But that is a fairly vast difference in scale. So the answer, I suppose, is whatever seems appropriate. For you, you don't think that there's any incongruity about that kind of vast variation in scale. For you, it's whatever seems appropriate. Whatever it is you want to explore, the medium itself.
No, I mean the particles in the CERN are not appropriate to me. That makes me feel. Or the vast in the cosmos. This billions of light years away. This is not appropriate. That's another thing.
Good, right, so we found the parameters which are the last. I mean, I spent this evening beginning trying to get to admit that there was a relationship with Aleppo, but we've now got macrocosmic and cosmologically all over the place. I suppose the notion of monument and memorial and memory is something that people have seen in a lot of your art. Is that an idea, or are those ideas that you explore consciously, or is it just the result of what it is that you produce?
I think the monuments, when I paint a monument in my painting, it's always very ironic. No, it's a monument for the unknown painter, for example, or things like back then.
Or monuments of Mao that have now been disbanded, or the Valhalla monument.
Yeah, it's all... I'm amusing myself with these monuments.
But are you consciously trying to forge an appropriate language for the monumental, or the monument today? I mean, the towers in the Royal Academy courtyard, Jericho, were they monuments or anti-monuments, or neither?
Or it wasn't a monument, because it was supposed to be there for, I don't know, for, I don't know.
3 months, but yeah.
And then we put it away. No, it's not a monument, you know, because it had no sense. A monument has a sense to do it for Beethoven or for Goethe to do a monument. But this was not for someone, so it was just... No, I wouldn't say it was a monument. It was a playground.
Which brings us back to the studio, I suppose, and to Barjac. And you talked about your childhood amongst the ruins. And the ruin is the fragment is something very strong, I think, in your work, and its historical resonances. Do you have to resist the temptation to make things whole, to heal things, or to fix things? Or is that part of the impulse that is never quite realized?
Oh, when you say fix, this word I don't understand. But when I have a ruin in front of me, then it's for me a beginning. Because we have the elements, we have the material to do something new. And for this reason, a ruin is for me much more complete than a finished building. And I was, as a child, I had no gadget.
Yeah, technology.
No, yeah, nothing. So I had just the bricks, it was all that I had. So I built houses and things I cannot stop.
You said the ruin is for your beginning. You were involved in, I mean, you directed, created an opera called, in the beginning, I'm a fan, in Paris. And the towers, which you can see now, which are also in the Valhalla paintings and are a reoccurring motif, were central to that stage production installation, as I saw it at the time. Now you're using them again, Valhalla, as I've said, the Wagnerian connotations are there. Could we ever see Kiefer producing a full Ring cycle? Are you still wrestling with the idea of operatic productions? Because I know you didn't think Amman Fein succeeded.
No, we had a project with Klaus Michael Gruber, who is a German director who died, and I worked so well with him. I had 2 projects with him, and he was proposed to do the Ring in Milano, in the
Scala.
In the Scala, and then he died, unfortunately, and then I didn't want to do it anymore, because this was the best director I could find, and he died, unfortunately. So once I will do this again, something, but for the moment I'm a painter.
If people say your paintings and sculptures and installations are theatrical, is that an insult to you? If people find your work theatrical?
They want to be insulted when they say this. But it doesn't insult them. Because you know, what is a theater? I do a theater. For example, I don't want good paintings in any circumstances. I have been about time. I built for each painting or each group of painting a building. Because the paintings need protection. Then they can then they can radiate from a secure point out. And this is theater, if you want. And so it's just a definition of what is theatrical. I have my definition.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It is used as an insult, sound. I mean, dramatic is also a term of not used so insultingly. But I'm also interested in that idea of installation, immersion, the architectural motif, the physical architecture of these towers, the architectural nature as well as the architectonic nature of Barjac. How are you working with architects as we're in the Royal Institute of British Architects?
I never, in my place in south of France, it's a big place, and I did a lot of things there, but I never consulted an architect, nor even an engineer. I built it myself with my assistant, one over the other, and I had the wish that it gets a little bit what is it?
Well, waves, it rocks, yeah.
That it goes a little bit down, a little bit. It doesn't. It's this.
So there's no, the one arena, I suppose, that you haven't dabbled with, that is an insult, but not meant. But the one arena you haven't moved into fully is the design of functional buildings. Were you ever tempted, or are you ever tempted, to move into the realms of architecture? Actually, maybe your to move more into the realms of architecture. I mean, maybe your studio is.
No, you know, I did in the place in Croissy-Beaubourg near Paris. What I did, I did one building for galleries. You know, the prototype building of a good gallery. And I wait still if one gallerist do it like this somewhere.
You call this, you just remind, of course you did, yeah, I thought Bill Katz helped you, but you did this. You might describe to people what the proportions of the perfect gallery are then, roughly, what are the proportions?
So they should be a little bit higher than wide, because these are elements of Renaissance of the churches, but it's wonderful, you know. If you have a little bit higher than wide, width, a bit, then you feel about.
Yeah, but how big is your created gallery?
It's not so big, it's
20 meters tall?
It's 20 meters tall, yes.
And how wide?
It's perhaps 28, and long it's, I think, 50.
60?
60, okay.
Yes. So, large?
It depends. Compared to my studio, it's small. I call it tea house.
Yeah, so you do, indeed it is. Final area I just wanted to talk to you about before we throw you out to the floor, that's all right, is
I'm getting a little bit confused about height.
Yeah, I do, obviously I've got a height complex, but a man who thinks 20 metres is small, obviously, has a slightly different way of seeing the world than I do, but I know you do. You're now 71. You could say you're approaching your artistic maturity. yeah. In the next 10, 15, 20 years? Do you have a sense of what it is you want to realise or achieve, or are you still so immersed in the process of making art that you don't think in those ways?
You mean if I have a concept?
Yes, and I suppose a broader plan as to what the next 20 years
are. I have always concept, and then I change them immediately. You know, I never execute, it's very rare that I execute my concept, because then it comes something against, and then I change the concept, but I go forward.
You made a show at the Royal Academy in 2014, which had a retrospective beginning and then a series of theme rooms that you were very involved in installing, making, and selecting. The Pompidou show was perhaps more of a retrospective and even larger. I just wonder whether making those kind of exhibitions now, which means looking back as well as looking forward, I wonder whether it has any impact on the way that you approach your practice or the way you see the possibilities of going forward.
Not so much. I think retrospectives are extremely boring for an artist, because you see all your old paintings and all this stuff. You have to do it because you want to be famous, you know. But
for the best.
But it's boring. It's not what I want. I prefer to do something new, a new experience, and so on. And also, they don't let me touch my painting, so it's always...
Yeah, and so we come full circle, as is so often the case in your work. I've had enough, Anton, I'm going to chuck you out on the floor, actually, because we've got 25 minutes, or 20 minutes left. If there are questions, I'm sure there are, although don't worry if you haven't got questions. But there's a microphone, so could you just wait for the microphone? What do you think you'd like to ask questions?
was very struck by the Kabbalistic Tree of Life in the exhibition at White Cube. It just seemed to have a totally different energy, if you will, from the other pieces. Could you, something about that?
I reflected quite a long time to put this in because it has nothing to do with Valhalla. But it has to do something with me because, you know, I studied a lot this Tree of Life, Mina Hoffmann, Heise von Lenzer, and Tiberet, and Malkuth, and Keter, and I learned this, and I meditated with this, you know, it goes around on my body like this, and I go from Mina to Hoffmann, to Lenzer, to, and so on. I put it in because first it's very me too, and it also after all these Valhalla things, I needed something serious.
It seemed like a symbol of hope in all that.
A hope
in that Valhalla.
No, I mean my towers have hope because they are damaged. You know, that they can be reconstructed.
Thank you.
Yes, in one of the rooms in the White Cube Gallery, there is all these magic powders in the Spanish language.
Powders?
Powders, yes, magic powders.
Are they alchemical?
Samples of magic powders in the Spanish language written there.
Is
that related to religion or is it black magic?
Ah, you mean in the arsenal?
Yes, in the arsenal.
I was in Mexico several times. And you can buy there these little envelopes with powders. Yeah. You can, if you want to produce women, buy this powder. If you have problems with your neighbor, the white powder, put it in his forgotten and he gets killed. And so, this powder is Michigan. And I thought, completely crazy, this powder. Find powder for everything, you know? So they sell it in Mexico at the market, you know?
So, how the hell you got that from British customs?
I had problems with the British customs. No, the British is a German customs. I was a German.
It's human then. It's not religion, it's no magic, black magic, it's human.
Yeah, sometimes I'm humoristic, you know.
Absurdist, I suppose you might say.
Tim asked you about transformation. He asked you about redemption, and you countered with transformation. So things just change.
For me, it's difficult. For example, forgiveness. How you can forgive when you killed 6 million Jews? You know, it's a word that doesn't function anymore, you know. And redemption. I think, as a painter, you cannot be redempted. You can transform things, and because if it's a redemption, then it's a status ante quem. Then you can then it's all fine. You know, it's all fine. But for me, nothing is all fine. You know, it's always in the same row, turning row.
Okay. Given your view that the human project is flawed, the human beings have evolved, you know, as you said, with summarizing. Does it ever make you question why you bother anymore? I mean, why still make art in the face of that fundamental flaw or pessimism?
As a word, I'm not pessimist, but I'm not optimist. This is words I don't use. But why I continue? I think I wouldn't live if I wouldn't continue. It's my life. It's absolutely necessary, and I cannot.
Does it seem futile
though ever, futile, pointless, without anything other than a personal need to do it?
No, because it becomes a personal need, because you are exercising all the time, üben, sure. And then you acquire so much knowledge, in a way, so much wisdom, that you don't want to give it, you don't want to put it on the garbage, you want to learn.
Is there anything broadly cathartic for you, though, about making work? When you read of humanity's inhumanity, does making work about it, in a sense, purge a kind of anger or frustration, or is that not how you think?
No. You know, as an artist or a writer, even the most horrible thing you use as a material, or the most horrible story, or at the end, it's beautiful. You know, you're to that. It's not possible to do something what's not beautiful.
Has your identity? Are you, so you said you felt very close to or connected to various historic people, particularly the poets, so Paul Celan and Ingeborg Bachmann in particular. Given that they both were working through in the aftermath of, you know, extraordinarily traumatic horrors, and in a sense challenged Adorno's notion that after the Holocaust it wasn't possible to create or make meaningful art. Has your own connection with them got deeper as you get older and witness more and more the world's violent or flawed nature, or is your relationship to them pretty constant in over the last 3-4 decades?
No, it gets deeper because I understand. From time to time, suppose from Zidane, from Bachmann, from others, and even sometimes from Ilias. I don't speak so well English, but I make the translation, and on the other side, I have the English text. So even there, I get deeper involved, I must say, because I see always more things. So my picture of this poem gets wider and wider.
And you said that poetry is a great source or a help for you, but was there ever a time when you thought about being a poet when you were young?
No, I think all what we see all our life is an illusion. You are an illusion, you see me as an illusion, and the only thing what is real is a poem. The poem is so concentrated, so well done, so fantastic, that this is a reality. And and you asked me why I'm not a writer, or what was it?
No, I asked you if you were, when you were a very young man.
Oh yeah, I had some success in some writers. So I was always a little bit in the ambiguity to be a writer or a painter or an artist. And but now this is done because you cannot do both.
But so you do combine both on occasions. Your paintings have literary text and then.
Yes, but this is not combining literature, and it's something else. It's just to finish the painting. It's not no. I think I could do a writer. I could be a writer, but then I had to stop to paint.
Yeah, question from Salma. I just wonder whether Thomas Schiffman's comment on the influence of Joseph Beuys on your work, and maybe on contemporary art in general.
So the influence of Joseph Beuys on your work, and the influence of Beuys in general on contemporary art?
You mean on contemporary art in general, or on me?
Both, starting with you, and then on Morgan.
So when I met Beuys, I was already I didn't finish, but I was already what you call a mature artist. No?
You're way off the brush of maturity.
Because I had already my diploma, you know. And then I was going to visit Beuys. And I visited him sometimes and showed him my work, and so, but I was never included in the class. So there was not so much influence, there was more it was more like a colleague, you know, who inspired me. And what was another sense?
But his impact more broadly on contemporary art.
Oh, I think he's the greatest artist of the second 20th century, so he will be, he is very influential, I'm sure.
Did his role or the impact ever encourage you to teach? Because you are not known to be a teacher in the last 15, 20 years. Were you ever interested in teaching?
No, I never did. But I have still some time.
Maturity can be a long time.
Sorry. One of my interests in your work is always, I've seen you as a history painter. One of the great themes of your work is history, and the creation of this, the influences on the post-war world. And I feel at the moment that, you know, a lot of writers write off always defining great moments, changes in history. But I think at the moment there is a genuine question raised about that post-war consensus is about to collapse. So I don't want to get into politics about the US election and Brexit and the possible elections about to happen in Europe. But it seems to me you've really engaged all the complexity of post-war history in your art as well as in the other. And I wonder if you feel something happening in relation to what's happening in the world at the moment in your art, or do you feel something might change in your art, or how do you deal with history in your art?
No,
I'm
informed. I look at every newspaper and all, and what I see now is really threatening. What I see in Europe, what I see in America, it's a heavy populism is going on, and then this direct democratic movement. I'm against direct democracy because brings us immediately to the wall. And so I'm informed, I'm interested, but I don't make a painting out of this, you know. And certainly it will be in a way, but not so visible, you know.
I think it's a really, well, my point, I thought you were going to do better than me, and you did actually, but I've often tried to ask you that, so why history painter, and I think you are, but you always resist the description of history painting because it has connotations of the academic.
No, because there are a lot of bad history painters like Meissonier and they make a naturalism, and they do a sport, they do it that they are a bird.
Turner was a history
painter. In this case, I would say fantastic. Turner is an history painter, is a fantastic history painter. And not only because he painted this Regensburg kitschy thing, you know.
Yeah, so
I was so surprised that in the print, you know, he painted Valhalla.
But so Turner's an example of a very powerful history painter. Why are you not admitting to being a contemporary history painter? The qualities are bad kinds of every artist. Why do you not define yourself in certain ways as a history painter? You've said on numerous occasions that history is your central subject.
Sure. But history is for me not something you have to illustrate. History is something you have to create. So because each scientist too, who works about history facts, he changes them all the time. So there is no objective history. So Jules Michelet, for example, and other historians, they are completely different, you know. And history is like mud, like
clay or material.
It's a clay, what you can form.
So it's a construct, I suppose.
It's a material. It's a material.
The corridor in the White Cube exhibition with the lead beds there seems to me at the end of the corridor there is a photograph of a figure walking away, and there's one lamp there beside it that is facing at a different angle. It's facing towards that figure, and I was just interested in it is the lone figure in that whole exhibition, what that represents.
That's me who goes away. It's a photo from the 60s. I thought it's nice to see the artist going away, going out of the theater, and let the thing work in the head of the public.
I suppose also the whole notion of Valhalla and the beds, the empty beds with traces of people having been in there, or beds that eventually will receive the fallen in the mythology. I suppose that notion of presence and absence is reiterated by the figure leaving. I mean, it's a figure that is there, but is in the process of leaving.
Yes, I think that it shows also that the artist is not so important. He goes away and leaves his thing. Because what he did is not only him, he did it. It's also the tradition who is in the work. And you should not look at the artist, you should look at his work.
Let's time for one more question, otherwise I'll end it. Then you'll back.
About the exhibition in the exhibition in China, and as a Chinese, when I heard the news, I was really excited. Finally, they're going to do some great show, but it turns out they didn't get your permission. So, I want to know your view on this, and did this give you a bad impression about China or like an Asian market in general? Thank you.
No, I was. I'm upset about that. So they do a show, and it's a lady who does the show without asking me. It's raping a man, you know, it's horrible. And I protested, and they did it nevertheless. So they treat me like a dead artist, you know, and I'm not dead, you know. They should ask me when they do that perspective, because you can put anything in a room together what you just find, you know. It's a retrospective, has to be formed. It had a lot of thoughts in them, and no, this is something really horrible. I think this lady has some interest. I don't know what kind of interest to do this without me. Never. We want to call her, and she doesn't respond.
So the show is now opened. It's in the Central Academy of Fine Arts in Beijing, and the Central Academy itself is slightly caught in the middle of all this, isn't it? The Central Academy itself is slightly caught in the middle of an agency from Germany and the people in China who want to see your work and the students and so on. Well, I was just trying to give a slightly broader view on, you were talking about this woman, who I think is part of an agency or a museum in Germany.
That's an agency is included, who does. And I had a letter from another Chinese artist in this agency, Duke. That he wrote me a letter, a Chinese artist, and that this lady did something she bought something from him, she didn't pay, and so something, some horrible things going on there. What is the name of this agency?
Thank God, I don't know. I can tell you quietly afterwards, when I find out. Oh, I don't know it, thank goodness. I'm sure you can read about it in the newspapers tomorrow. But she's from a museum, I think, isn't she?
She is from the Ludwig Museum, and she is a curator. She is paid by the Ludwig Museum. And she made, with the Ludwig Museum, with a renommé of the Ludwig Museum, she did the show. But the Ludwig Museum is not involved, you know? The Ludwig Museum doesn't know anything about that. And then she was going there. It was done with me. It was all a lie, all a lie. So, but
final question, Anton, which stems from this, which obviously, when you move on out of this realm and into another, you won't be able to control your work, as you say, when you're dead, you won't have control over how you're going to see. But as long as you're alive, you want to make shows, you want to get involved in shows, that the retrospective is slightly boring to you just looking back. But how?
What is, in a sense, what are the parameters or conditions that you would like to suggest curators or historians or the custodians of your reputation in the future? What should they adhere to? Because I'm not defending the show, but it is all work that you've made. Therefore, by definition, there must be good and bad ways of presenting your work. What are the, in a nutshell, it's a very difficult question, but what the hell? How should we in the future, well, I won't be around, but how should people in the future look to present your work? How would you like it to be presented?
This is something to work on, to write off some paragraphs, but I'm not prepared for that. I can try to do it. So I do now most of what they have to follow, no?
Yeah, but in a way, Barjac itself, I would imagine, is a kind of example and an achievement in and of itself of the way that you...
I will give it to some foundation of the state, or I will give it away, so then it stays like it is. This is, Barjac is easier, because it's all done by me, and all these buildings. And if they conserve it, then we have a good example for good curating.
Okay. On which sort of resolved note, which is very key for us, we should end this evening. Tomorrow night, the opening is at Whitecambe and Bermondsey. So many of you have seen the show today, but please, I hope the rest of you feel able to get in tomorrow. And so it's always a pleasure. It was difficult, it's always a pleasure. And I thank you on behalf of all of us for being here in London.